T. Houston.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Want to do radio? KVFT is looking for programmers and board ops. If this sounds like you, contact me, Marlo Blue, at pdkpft@gmail.com or leave a message at 713-526-4000 extension 1003. Hey, KPFT is looking for you.
Hi, I'm Mel.
And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
T. Houston, People of Earth, is next.
Crying looking for you. I'm crying looking for you.
This is KPFT Community Radio, 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 FM in Huntsville. People of Earth, indigenous radio that advocates for indigenous peoples, communities, self-determination in honor of those who have gone before and the resilience of the indigenous culture that is today very much alive.
No.
going home to her nation, Six Nations, to all her faces I did not know, no, no. Beating hearts, come as one, come as one. This is Indian country. This is Indian country.
Yeah, that's Stomp Dance. That's kind of on the old, a little bit old, Robbie Robertson. You're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. People of Earth, we just came along through a fun drive. Really grateful that we are here and able to have a fun drive, that we can stay commercial free, blah, 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 all good things, you know. But we'll just mention again, if you want to still donate at this time, always, please, we're always welcome. And we want to thank people like Brant and Stephanie and James and people that stepped up and wanted to keep this going strong. Really, thank you so much for honoring us in that way. So I want to move on to this information. In Alaska, the permafrost thaws leaving. As it thaws, it is leaving in its place mush, what would be hardened. But since it's not, it's causing coastal degradation, and also Arctic waters are not freezing now the same as usual. The warming permafrost protects against erosion, but now that it's been melting due to climate change, it is no longer holding the sediment in place. So when Typhoon Halong hit this fall, many native villages were devastated and evacuated. In an article from November 3rd by Myasel Spotted Elk, who wrote for High Country News, that nearly 50 Alaska Native communities across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta near the Bering Sea were met with towering wind speeds, record storm surge, and widespread flooding. Also, that there is experienced toxic chemicals spilling into its fresh water supply. The article also says that rising temperatures have changed the nature of tropical cyclones, leading to heavier rainfall, hurricane-like winds, and taller waves. And also that many of the Alaska Native villages affected by Typhoon Halong were established in coastal areas as a result of colonial policies imposed by the United States government, and talks about the history from the time when Russia sold the land to the United States, and also that the boarding school era played a crucial role in how villages were organized. In May, May this year, the Environmental Protection Agency canceled a $20 million flood protection grant awarded by the Biden administration last year. This landmark grant was expected to accelerate relocation for many villages. At this time, the indigenous leaders of the area have elected to proceed with relocation, and also FEMA has announced disaster relief. So, also, I want to mention that, November 10 to the 21st, world leaders, scientists, activists, negotiators, diplomats, indigenous peoples, all kinds of people caring about the climate events will gather in Belém, Brazil for COP 30. And that other affected communities, all of these communities are there for the annual UN Climate Conference. It is the first COP conference since the news that the world passed the 1.5°C climate threshold, shorthand for global average threshold of heating above pre-industrial levels, a limit long considered vital to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. This milestone underscores urgency. Human rights is a crucial part of climate justice. Environmental human rights defenders on the front lines of climate change need always to be protected. Indigenous people on the front lines who've been fighting for a long time need to be allowed meaningful participation in climate decision making. COP, or the Conference of Parties, is an annual meeting where states work together to make concrete commitments. They come up with solutions to address climate change, or they're supposed to. It's all of our right to live in clean, healthy environments. At this time, frontline communities are those who bear the direct or indirect impacts of the climate crisis, as the village in Alaska devastated by Typhoon Halong. Fenceline communities, the people who live near industrial infrastructure, including locations where fossil fuels are extracted, processed, and burned, are often already marginalized and racialized people, directly experience the adverse impact of pollution, environmental degradation. Climate Week took place in New York City this year, in late September, just before the annual meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, just like at the annual international climate meetings known as the COP, Climate Week has been infiltrated by corporations that are largely responsible for creating climate crisis that these global gatherings are meant to address. There, fossil fuel companies make side deals with governments and multinational corporations that siphon huge amounts of water from the neediest populations, and also on hand seeking endorsement for what they say are their sustainable operations. But Climate Week still offers grassroots organizations the platform to raise issues and visibility on many issues of climate justice and indigenous rights. So right now we're going to hear a little bit from that, as from Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dr. Crystal Cavalier-Keck, founder of
Directions of Service, an indigenous organization. So in just a few moments. And let me also say that you're listening to People of Earth. People of Earth, it is indigenous. People of Earth, here on KPFT.
Took place in New York City this year from September 21st to the 28th, just before the annual meeting of the United Nations General Assembly. Just like at the annual International Climate Meetings, known as the Conference of Parties or COP, Climate Week has been infiltrated by the corporations that are largely responsible for creating the climate crisis that these global gatherings are meant to address. Their fossil fuel companies make side deals with governments and multinational corporations like Coca-Cola and Nestle that siphon huge amounts of water from the neediest populations are also on hand seeking endorsements for what they say are their sustainable operations. But Climate Week still offers grassroots organizations a platform to raise the visibility of issues such as climate justice and indigenous rights. One of these groups is Seven Directions of Service, an indigenous-led organization rooted in environmental justice and grassroots power, operating on the ancestral homelands of the Okanichi Saponi in rural North Carolina. Its mission is to protect sacred places, advocate for the legal recognition of rights of nature, and establish a land, language, and cultural center grounded in traditional Yesa teachings. The group is committed to serving as a powerful voice for the lands and waters beyond a solely human-centered view of the world. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dr. Crystal Cavalier Keck, co-founder with her husband Jason Crazy Bear of Seven Directions of Service. She made four presentations during Climate Week at the UN and summarizes the information shared here.
On our first one, we talked about United Nations sustainability, and that was talking about how we were going to get the climate goals that the United Nations has put out to how we're going to be able to meet these 2030 sustainability goals. And I just really don't think we're going to be able to meet these sustainability goals because of the United States' global reach. So we're going to have to come back to the drawing board. But then also hearing President Trump at the United Nations was just a travesty because he's not really out here trying to nation build with other nations. And just hearing him just spill out this rhetoric, it's, well, number one, it's embarrassing because I'm just having this secondhand embarrassment. Like, how could he just sit on the world stage and say these things? And I don't know if he believes it or not, but God, he looks like an idiot. Right. And I'm just like, this is who we have representing us. And it's embarrassing. The second one was talking about moving towards a rights of nature based in our legal way. So just changing the way we think legally, we are looking at these things as not as resources, but as responsibilities. Right. So change the way you look at a dandelion or change the way you look at water. Because these are gifts that was given to us, or you can't exist without these things, right? And that's what I keep saying about people are not looking at the bigger picture. If Bayer owns Monsanto, and those are two things, like they have a pharmaceutical company, and then you have a toxin company. The toxin company is killing off herbs that get rid of cancers, versus buy all of these cancer drugs that people can't afford anymore. You know, if you incorporate those dandelion leaves into your salad, you know, it helps your body release the toxins because it's a bitter leaf. But when you have things like this fighting against each other, it just cancels out the everyday people. I just think back that we have elected these leaders to speak on our behalf and make the big decisions. That's why we're able to live our life. But now we're getting in this because he's not representing us. So we talked about that, how we're going to bring control back to our communities and how we're going to have to live it in a different way. So all of our communities together can unite and work together when we're trying to fight about issues. Because if we bring it back to a responsibility to protect what's sacred, like the earth and the water and the air that we breathe, then we will be able to understand that all of these things are a gift. The next one, we talked about the Gulf South to Appalachia, just to talk about all of these pipelines, oil refineries, the petrochemicals, all of these environmental harms that's happening. We have to come together and fight back, because it takes the frack gas to fuel these petrochemical plants that makes like everything that's in like some type of plastic bottle, right? And saying that we have to work together. And then the last one at the UN Climate Week, we worked with Movement Rights, and they're our partners when we talk about the rights of nature. And we talked about how we really needed to dismantle and get off this fossil fuel, because when you extract so much from the earth, not only are you doing a disservice below the surface, you will deplete whatever is in the earth. And so we were talking about that and how we need to bring in traditional ecological knowledge and elders from the community and just really think about this in a common sense way, in a sustainable way that's going to sustain us to live on this earth before we destroy it.
That was Dr. Crystal Cavalier Keck, co-founder of Seven Directions of Service.
Witnessing disgrace behind theater, and then chasing moonlight just to be divided. And Athabascan theory glinting, dragging her feet.
So, hey there, you're listening to KPFT 90.1 FM. KPFT.org. I'm Jacqueline. Thanks for being here. Thanks for supporting KPFT during our fun drive. We really appreciate you, you all that have stepped up and keep us alive here on these airwaves, keeping them free. So yeah, again, also now coming from Between the Lines again with Melinda Too, who's talking with Almond Alex, co-founder and co-director of the Gulf of Mexico Youth Climate Summit. It's a group of 800 young people from all around the Gulf, Mexico to the U.S. and other places in the Gulf. So I'm going to get to that in a few seconds here on 90.1 FM.
A good feeling coughed out left.
Armon Alex, co-founder and co-director of the Gulf of Mexico Youth Climate Summit, a group of 800 young people from all around the Gulf, from Mexico to the U.S. and the Caribbean, working to protect the Gulf region through education, advocacy, and direct action. Alex was born and raised in Corpus Christi, Texas, on the Gulf Coast, where the city's natural beauty sharply contrasts with six massive fossil fuel refineries that increased the risk of respiratory illnesses and cancers among residents there. Here he describes the origins of the Gulf Youth Climate Summit and its mission.
That was started because there was a lack of youth and a lack of women and a lack of people of color in academic and scientific spaces. And what we recognize is when you have that lack of representation, perspective is lost. Absolutely. It is well documented in science that there's such a thing as biased science from a perspective. You simply don't approach a problem in the same way as you would someone with differing perspective and lived experience. But I'm here because my community, for far too long, like many others in the U.S. Gulf South, Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, have continued to be dubbed as sacrifice zones by oil and gas executives, by politicians who bend the knee to oil and gas money through PACs, et cetera, and through lobbying efforts. And enough is enough. You know, we've far too long seen way too many of our loved ones quite literally die because of the direct impacts to their health from living next door. And all we want at the end of the day is to live a healthy life so that we can see our grandchildren grow, so that we can see our brothers and our sisters grow, our family members smile at the dining room table. And it's unfortunate that the Gulf South, as much as it is a place of resilience, is also a place where blood is in the water. And so that's why I'm here in D.C. with so many incredible others, comrades and allies here.
The Trump administration is going all out. You know, basically, he promised before the election, if the fossil fuel industry gave him $1 billion, he would deliver for them. And he's doing that in a big way, really promoting as much as possible, fast-tracking everything to do with fossil fuels and de-tracking anything to do with renewables. What do you want to see happen? What do you think could happen that would benefit your community in the current situation?
From my point of view, living in the Gulf South, we know that any growth for industry quite literally delivers death with it. When this current administration decides that they want to go full throttle on expanding and creating more profit for these greedy billionaires and oil and gas CEOs, we know that that means we will continue to see in an exponential fashion the passing of our loved ones due to the impacts of fossil fuels have in our communities. You know, I think that this also serves as a moment in which we are seeing our communities band together to push back against this authoritarian regime that we're facing right now. We are helping our family, our friends, people from across the world, our neighbors, gain this consciousness about it's not a left or right issue, but rather a top-heavy to working-class people issue. Beyond that, we know that still at the end of the day, the Trump administration is going to expand oil and gas. We need to do and continue to organize our communities to push back. That is at our local levels. That's at our state levels and our federal levels. Of course, he's going to do everything that he can at the federal level. States like mine, like Texas, when you have a governor like ours, or rather in Florida or Louisiana, they're going to continue to push these sacrifice zones. It's quite unfortunate. You know, residents of Texas can't even rely on our state environmental agency because it's a rubber stamp for oil and gas permits. So that's an unreliable place to go. But nevertheless, we should still engage in those spaces so that it is well documented across time that our communities continue to undergo the worst impacts just for some profits. On a local level, there's also work that can be done. We saw this in the first administration, where a lot of the things that he was pushing from the federal level had an opportunity to be delayed and have some defense on local levels because it was up to them to institute some of those things. As it relates to oil and gas expansion on a local level, there is needed cooperation from local cities to be able to push those things forward. And so whether we are here in D.C. or there at a city council meeting in your city, our ability to be able to use our voice and speak up to push back is tangible. When we engage in this kind of defense as a revolutionary act of defiance, we are also in the process of strengthening our muscles to continue this fight. And we're bringing in others. There's been plenty of people that have said in the past, where there are people, there's power.
That was Armon Alex, co-founder and co-director of the Gulf of Mexico Youth Climate Summit.
People of Earth here, KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. Yeah. So, yes. Here I am here on KPFT, and just a minute here, I am going to talk with somebody here just to briefly talk about the fact that he's going to be on the next program this evening, and he's new to KPFT. He comes on at 9 o'clock with the program called Tsunami.
It's a new wave tsunami.
Tsunami wave. Okay.
We're playing music from about 1977 to the early 90s.
Yeah.
You know, actually, I'm not sure when the new wave era stopped. In fact, I think we're going to do a show one day and try to figure that out. But it's primarily 80s music with a little bit of late 70s and early 90s interspersed.
That's great. And I imagine you play some things that aren't so the really recognized stuff, and maybe some of the things that people don't, you know, didn't hear on the radio.
Well, I've been kind of starting with the recognized stuff and working my way down into the more obscure things. Yeah. So, you know, there are just certain things. If you're going to have a new wave show, then you just got to play Flock of Seagulls. I mean, what kind of new wave show doesn't play Flock of Seagulls? At least once.
Okay. Well, I won't even talk to you too long because you're going to have a real interview coming up on the next program.
Yes, we are. I'm not sure exactly what all that it's going to entail, but it's going to be fun.
I bet it's going to be interesting. Really, yes. Really interesting. So you're going to be there for the show.
Sonic Reducer.
Yes, the Sonic Reducer. And he's also a very clever guy. He really knows what he's doing. He plays this. He knows the genre he's in.
Absolutely. I mean, he's worked in the genre for many years.
Musician.
He was a drummer. Yeah.
You're a musician.
And I'm a musician as well. Yeah, I had a new wave band, punk band, you know, in the 80s, a couple of them, a couple different ones. Yeah. And then, I'm still a musician. That's what I've done most of my life for a living, or, you know, I've scraped a living out of it.
Well, I didn't want to go overboard in the interview because you're going to be going all in the next hour. I just wanted to also, because you're new to KPFT, and so you're part of the new lineup.
The show just started in August, so this is going to be the 12th show tonight.
Okay. Yeah, and so, but can I ask, or would you mind, what was one of your band names?
I was in a band called Volumatics. And that's the band we're going to be talking about tonight on Dave's show. And we used to play around town. We existed from about 1980 to 1984. And we used to play all the Fitzgeralds, Rockefellers, the Island, the Roxy, the Escape, all the different clubs. And so, yeah.
Well, okay. Well, I thank you so much for spending these moments. And just to let people know what KPFT is doing, these are, well, the next show is relatively new also. He's been longer than you, but he's still relatively new. This, I can't remember when he actually started, and then now you. And so, okay, I appreciate you spending some time here.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're listening to People of Earth on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org, and People of Earth, it is Indigenous Radio. So, yeah, we're listening to Tribalistas right there. That's some Indigenous music coming out of Brazil. So, so there's some of that. And it's a great band, actually. So last week we talked about how the Klamath Dam was won, and how Amy Bowers Cordalis, an attorney and member of California's indigenous Yurok tribe, spent decades striving to restore the natural flow of the Klamath River in the United States. The Klamath, which runs through the states of Oregon and California, was once the third largest salmon-producing waterway in the western United States. But four hydroelectric dams built between 1911 and 1962 stifled the river's flow, decimating the local salmon populations. The fish are a keystone species and vital to the Yurok way of life. More recently, Cordalis and the Yurok celebrated as crews raised the last of the Klamath's four dams, all gone. The demolition was the result of a seismic 2022 decision in which federal regulators greenlit the removal of the dams and the restoration of the river. The ruling marked the culmination of decades of Yurok advocacy, protest, and legal action. Cordalis played a key role in the effort. She led the appeal to regulators and helped forge a negotiated agreement with California, Oregon, and the dam's owner that resulted in decommissioning the four structures.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Amy Bowers Cordalis. Her book is called The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. So, Amy, what were the shots across the bow or the real accelerators of you and your colleagues' case to dismantle the dams? If you could point to one or two lightning rod moments, what were they?
Yeah, and great question. So, after the Fishkill, there was a grassroots movement to undam the Klamath, and it started with the indigenous peoples of the Klamath Basin, and it was Yurok, Karuk, Hoopa, Klamath tribes, Shasta Nations. Like, it was a coalition of Indian people that went and protested at the dam owners, and it changed a couple of times, but eventually got to Berkshire Hathaway, PacifiCorp, which are all owned by one of the world's richest men, Warren Buffett, and they would protest these meetings. And then I think the sort of good medicine came into play. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, license to operate the Klamath dams expired in 2006. And so in 2004, FERC initiated a relicensing proceeding, which gave the Yurok tribe and eventually others the opportunity to request dam removal. And this was huge because we had a regulatory pathway to dam removal. When we first started this initiative, people
didn't think dam removal was possible. The state of California, for example, didn't even participate until way down the road. Oregon hardly participated. PacifiCorps asked for the dams to be relicensed consistent with the status quo. So, you know, no fish passage, no updates for environmental laws that had been passed in the past 50 years.
And what was the estimated cost of dismantling these dams?
We didn't know at that point when we first started. So, but that was one of the key things about the regulatory process, was that through this hearing, there was a hearing to relicense the dams. And during the hearing, we argued that the tribe's rights, established in my family's Supreme Court case, Mass versus Arnett, and then the subsequent precedent that developed since then, that's, you know, was clear that we had federally reserved fishing and water rights that were basically being destroyed by these dams. We coupled those with the Federal Power Act and with several other environmental laws, and teamed up with NGOs to make these really strong, strong arguments. Us, along with the Karuk tribes, the NGOs, made really strong arguments based on the, you know, the tribes reserved fishing water rights, these federal laws, environmental laws, to make the case that these dams were no longer in the public interest because they were harming salmon runs and indigenous rights. And we won on almost every account. And what that led to was basically a posturing where, if FERC was going to relicense the dams, they had to include fish prescriptions, which would have been installing fish ladders. So if PacifiCorps wanted to relicense the dams, they would have had to install fish ladders. And here's where the economics comes in. So we did an economic analysis, and it was cheaper to remove the dams than it was to install the fish ladders. And so that was our aha moment. And that was a major turning point in the whole thing, because all of the sudden it was cheaper to remove dams. That meant that PacifiCorps had an interest in removing the dams, and that interest was also ours. And so we pressed pause on the hearing and started settlement negotiations that led to a $515 million settlement agreement to remove the Klamath dams.
So can you break down the numbers of what it meant to break down this dam, Amy, in terms of the economics of it?
Yeah, the magnitude is hard to even digest. It is the world's largest river restoration project. So we removed four dams from the Middle Klamath River, and in that, we removed over 411 feet of dam. And what's really cool is that we were able to remove a lot of that material, and much of it was actually earthen dam, especially from the first dam, and put it back to where they had extracted the earth and the dirt. So we rebuilt the ecosystem in that way. We opened up over 400 miles of spawning habitat behind the dams. And then also in the former reservoir areas, we have planted over 19 billion native seeds. And so we are literally renewing the world in that area by rebuilding ecosystems, with first foods like acorns and willows that are used for basket making. It's really remarkable.
So what are the big takeaways for you from an environmental standpoint and from an indigenous people's standpoint in terms of this case? What template have you created that could be replicated elsewhere, Amy?
What we did on the Klamath is scalable. It is a scalable climate crisis solution model. And that's one of the things that makes me so excited. So through coalition building and empowering and uplifting the indigenous rights and coupling those rights with other environmental laws, with energy laws, that helped, really made it so that we had a very strong coalition of people working together, both on the legal strategy, but also on the politics side of things. And who developed important, deep relationships with one another, you know, power executives and tribal leaderships. And what that did was create a willingness to work together, and also an understanding of how everybody's interactions with the basins impacted everybody's way of life. And that led to empathy. And what that empathy did was then create a sort of like set the table for a negotiation that allowed us to come up with a settlement agreement that equally valued the rights of nature, indigenous peoples, and business. Combine these legal rights so that you're creating leverage for change, but also develop important relationships where you're understanding different ways of life so that you can develop empathy, trust, and respect. And then that empowers you to be in a position to enter into agreements that can get to better outcomes that are more equitable, more just, and create different outcomes that are better for the environment, for people, and also protect business. That's what we did on the Klamath. There's another point too, is that we can still, you know, have business and be profitable. Through the Klamath Dam Removal Project, we injected $515 million into the economy. One of the world's largest construction corporations, Kiewit, did the deconstruction, and they used similar techniques, engineerings, you know, yellow iron equipment to remove dams as they do to build dams. There is a model, and the Klamath is it, of how we can create a global restorative, regenerative, you know, nature-based solutions economy. We don't have to continue to just go around and extract and ruin environments. We can instead, you know, flip the narrative and start restoring these environments using very similar trainings and techniques and models as we did to build all this. There is a fundamental change that has to occur, which is, you know, nature, environment, people have to, indigenous peoples, all people's rights to have a healthy environment have to be respected. You know, we have to put that at the foundation of all of that work and change. But once you do that, you know, the sky's the limit. And that's what we've proved on the Klamath.
Well, congratulations on your legal successes, and it's all chronicled in this terrific book, The Water Remembers. Amy Bowers Cordalis, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. And so, yes, Amy Bowers Cordalis. People of Earth, it is Indigenous Radio.
Witnessing disgrace behind theater. And then chasing moonlight just to be divided. The Baskin theory glinting, dragging her feet under street lamps.
And I want to mention again that we have come out of our fun drive. We're pretty good. We can still reach out a little bit and ask you if you haven't done a part of contributing to KPFT. This would be a good time, especially if you want to support Indigenous voices, Indigenous people. So again, I'll just say this, 713-526-5738. It's never too late, kpft.org. And also that, go to kpft.org just to see what KPFT is doing and what KPFT is about and the many programs that we have here on these airwaves, keeping it real, keeping it free. That's what we're about. That's what we hope to keep going for a long, long time.
Witnessing disgrace behind theater. And then chasing moonlight just be divided. An Athabascan theory glinting, dragging her feet under street lamps. And she cries for her
I'm crying looking for you.
Okay, yeah, that's a beautiful song for Athabascan, a ballad of Athabascan by Hatual. Anyway, coming to the end here, people of Earth. Stay tuned. Keep listening to KPFT, and I'm signing out. So that's it. Okay, Chichalu.
It's a dirty, stupid, sad way of playing, but this lady, my heart has pulled me down to the dirt I'm wanting. The sweet solitude is fading.
Hi, this is Pat Byrne. You're listening to Houston's community station, KPFT.
Hey, y'all. I'm Anna Lamare. KPFT has been a supporter of my music since day one, and I'm grateful to be a part of this family. Thank you for helping spread independent local music. Support community radio. And this is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does. Especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Look through your children's eyes, and you will discover the true magic of a forest.
Find a forest near you and start exploring at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
I love this song!
I love nachos.
Loving everything? You might be buzzed.
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzz warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
What is dedication?
People ask, how your children learn how to ride a bike, and you didn't. I just created an environment where they taught themselves, and all I had to do was be there.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Thank you.